Welcome to Ripstop on the Record, a podcast where fabric enthusiasts and DIY gurus discuss all things make your own gear, with the occasional poor attempt at comedy to keep it interesting. I'm Kyle Baker, the owner and founder of Ripstop by the Roll, and we're excited to have you listening.
Hey, Amy, welcome to the episode.
Hey, Jameson, and hey, Avery. Thank you so much for having me. I am very excited to be on this podcast with you.
So we're going to talk a lot about your company, your design, the sewing, and all that stuff. But I don't want to forget the human behind it all. So besides a maker and a business owner, how would you define yourself?
I would define myself as a very, very proud Asian American woman. And I would also define myself as a designer. And I think if you had asked me 6 months ago if I considered myself a designer, I probably would say, hell no. But I do today. And I think that's because my mom actually pointed it out. She called me a designer. And I was like, are you serious? I don't see myself that way. But if you really think about it, the amount of thought that I put into my patterns and making sure that the patterns are repeatable so that I can make bags for my customers, right? All of that is design work. And I think that making a functional solution-oriented bag is all design work. So yeah, I consider myself a designer, and I'm also a very proud Asian American woman.
I love that. And I'm excited to get even more into your story because we hear a lot of maker stories after having 60 episodes, but your story is a little bit different. So tell us why you left your Facebook job to start making gear.
Yeah, I think that was a pretty wild decision on my end. And I don't think anyone really saw that coming. I certainly didn't. I think it really, I mean, at the core of who I am, my family, like, we consist of very independent and self-reliant women, right? And so we just really get shit done when we need to get shit done. Excuse my language. and, you know, the concept of making is no foreign thing to my family. I mean, even my older sister and I, we have this running joke. We have an I can make that list. I'm sure a lot of other makers listening can really relate to that. But we had this really long-running list. And I think, like, it wasn't until 2018 that I actually started to check things off of that list that related to sewing, because I had bought my first machine. I had the Singer Heavy Duty 4423. We all know that one. It RIP. It's no longer with me. I broke it. But yeah, so I spent so much time hemming a lot of my pants. I'm really short, so I just took the initiative. You know, I don't want to pay to get my pants hemmed. I'm just going to do it myself. And that's just true Guan fashion, to just do things yourself. And I think it wasn't until 2020 that I took sewing really seriously. I was still working at Facebook at the time. And whenever I had, you know, any off chance to work on the machine, I did. And I started to replicate some of my favorite pieces in my closet rather than buying more of the same thing. I wanted to just make more of the same thing. And, you know, making apparel was not easy. It was extremely difficult for me. And Jameson, I see you nodding your head. It looks like you can agree with that.
I don't even want to get into it. No.
Something I really gave up on pretty quickly. I just didn't understand, you know, at the time. I didn't do much research about different fabric types and, you know, how it's super important to understand, like, volume of stretch, right, depending on the type of garment. And so I had made this turtleneck, and I could not fit my head through it. So I said to myself, Amy, like, this probably isn't your area of expertise, so let's just, you know, set that aside. And then in 2020, I, you know, decided to just kind of pivot and try to make a fanny pack. And it was a very bare bones fanny pack. I noticed, like, you know, at the time it was the beginning of the pandemic, and running errands, going to the grocery store, going on hikes outdoors. That was a very common thing to do because that's all we could do, right? And I didn't have a bag for that kind of activity. You know, I had my big old backpacking bag, my 65 liter, right? I'm not going to take that to the grocery store, you know? So I decided to make myself a little EDC bag. And that to me was a fanny pack at the time. And so that was my very first piece. And so kind of to answer your question, like why I make gear, I think ultimately, you know, I know that I can make things. And I think just taking the time to apply that and, you know, pick up the machine and just do it. It's a really satisfying feeling, and making my gear like really provides confidence in me. And I'm sure a lot of us can really relate to that. The MYOG community, you know, we really own making things, and we're not afraid to make things and mess up and do it again. And, you know, the concept of MYOG just really resonates with me and just who I am at the core. So yeah, I just love making things. I don't know.
I'd be so curious to see what people call their list as you like the I can make it list, because like I've never thought of the official name for mine, but I'm pretty sure it'd be like the F around and find out list, because I'm so determined to make apparel, and yet everything I've made has been so bad, there's no reason why I should make more, but I still want to try.
Oh, you should more power to you, Jameson, but you know
it hasn't really worked for me yet. We need to get that, like, that needs to be like an official Instagram poll, Avery, I think, is like, what do you call the list of gear that you think you're going to make one day? And how much of the list do you actually get to?
I call mine, instead of a to-do list, I have a ta-da list, because it's just like, ta-da, it's done. So it feels better. I'm loving to know that people have different names for their sewing list or their to-do list or whatever it is. So if you have an interesting name, let us know, because I just think that's super fun. When you were talking about making gear and starting in the pandemic, there are a lot of things that came out of the pandemic, right? And for me, a lot of them is I'm at the age where all my friends are having babies, so lots of COVID babies. But in the same sense, there were lots of COVID MYOGers that came out of the pandemic and being stuck at home. I know I was one of them. I got on Ripstop because I was like, I need to sew something. I'm going to go crazy. So it's been really interesting as we've had these interviews with other small cottage companies that a lot of people did come out of the pandemic as sewers. So I think that's really inspiring to know that it wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't. I mean, 2020, you guys, and like, look at us now, our community, our MYOG community is so big, and it's so inspiring, you know? And also, you know, I'm not sure if it was like that on your end, but it was really difficult to get a sewing machine out here. Was it like that for you guys too?
That's a good question. There were definitely things that were hard to find. I had a sewing machine actually that my grandma bought me in high school. So I think I like went back home and got it and brought it back. And I was like, I'm going to start using it again. Now is the time. So definitely bicycles, sewing machines are definitely one of the things. And then yeast for making bread.
Yes.
So.
And of course, the infamous toilet paper.
Yeah. God forbid.
That's such a good point though, Avery. I never thought about like COVID babies and COVID companies, but the number of companies I can think about, like cottage companies that started in like the 2020 range, basically, I think I could pull at least five off the top of my head without even looking at a spreadsheet.
Yes.
At least.
Yeah.
Yeah. You would think, right, during a pandemic that folks would hunker down and really just stick to their consistent jobs that they had. And for me, right, I was at Facebook and I don't know what it was, but I just pulled the trigger and I said, I'm leaving and I'm just going to pursue this full time, you know, and just really glad I did. But yeah, I'm definitely a COVID, a result of the pandemic, you know?
Yeah.
I love that. Well, let's even dive more straight into what you're all about, but tell us what Motocot is.
Yeah. So Motocot is an Asian American soft goods company that's based in San Francisco, and it's pronounced Motocot. So perfect, Avery. I love, love, love hearing people say the word Motocot, because it's actually a phrase in my native Chinese dialect. And it was a saying that my grandmother used to say a lot. when she raised me and my two sisters. But yeah, it directly translates to nothing goes to waste or do not waste, depending on how you're using it. And yeah, the meaning's so, so special to me because my grandma, you know, whenever we would have dinner around the dinner table, my sisters and I would just want to, you know, hurry up and scarf down the food and just, you know, get back to our cartoons, right? And my grandma would always stop us and say, no, you guys have to finish, you know, every grain of rice, like morokat. You cannot waste the food. And we actually saw this not just like in food, but just materials around the house. We would reuse bottles and repurpose boxes and make toys out of really nothing, right? And so the concept of morokat has really been ingrained in me. And I've tried to apply that not just in material things, but also kind of the way that I live my life and just how I try to apply like my passions every day. So yeah, that's morokat. And shout out to my sister and both my sisters, Betty and Michelle. They actually helped me coin the name morokat because I just wasn't sure what I wanted to name my company when I was making these bags. And they're like, you know what? The way that you're going about your company and just, you know, the whole feeling around your brand is so morokat. So yeah, that's how morokat came to be.
That's amazing. That's a beautiful story too. I had read your article, or the article that was done about you. And I guess I hadn't fully pieced together the familial aspect of mm-hmm. that as well with your sisters and that coming obviously from your grandmother. That's such a beautiful story.
Yeah.
We talk to a lot of companies that have really specific customer bases, right? Highly technical gear for through hiking and section hiking, or even weekend warriors that are like constantly getting miles for something really, really specific. Mm-hmm. Your gear is not, and this is not remotely a slight, but it's not that specific, where it's not like for through hiking the AT, or it's not a one person shelter with a waterproof bathtub floor and a mesh. Like it's not that cut and dry.
Yes.
Who are Motocon's customers?
Yeah. I'm a big data person. And so once I launched my website, I was actually able to see data on who my customers were. And I noticed that they actually vary in age. And I mean, I've had customers who are super young. I mean, I think their parents actually bought the bag for them, but they're super young. So I have people who rock my bags anywhere from the age of like 15 to 70, right? And that's a huge range. And I think depending on how folks discover morokat, that really determines, you know, what type of person it is. So oftentimes through IG, I tend to gravitate towards a more younger crowd. And then for the folks who have found me through like the local paper, they tend to be a little bit older. But you're absolutely right, Jameson. I think that my bags do not really cater to one specific type of person, which I really love. I love that morokat can speak to so many different types of people, whether that's men or women. It doesn't matter, right? I see tons of people rocking my bags and I'm always surprised. Like, wow, even my mom rocks my bags, and I'm probably because she's biased, but but you know, it seems like it doesn't really matter the age or, you know, the types of activities that they do. I have avid cyclists that rock my bags, and I have folks who just use it to walk their dog. And I love that. Yeah.
So we're going to talk more about your design and stuff after. So I don't want to skip beyond that without acknowledging it. But I do want to tap into your brand more. A lot of small businesses don't put too much effort into branding. And even the word brand is kind of almost taboo in a sense, where it feels very like corporate, kind of salesy, a little bit slimy sometimes, if you want to put it that way. Yeah. But as the brand manager here at Ripstop, it's something that I really appreciate seeing. There's a remarkable amount of effort, but also intentionality that you put into Motocot's brand, from your website to the design of your gear that we have a little bit here in the office if you're watching the YouTube, but even your Instagram. The question that I'm kind of leading to here is what sort of effect have you seen on your customers with the effort and the design you've put into creating a brand, not just gear? A lot of companies make phenomenal gear and yours is no exception to that, but you've put a lot of effort into creating a feeling and a representation and a lot more around your brand.
Yeah, I I think that I've noticed that there's a lot more awareness and excitement towards slow fashion because of, I mean, it's not just me, right? A lot of other brands are doing this too. But I've noticed that customers don't really care about the lead time as much anymore, even though they initially were a little, you know, taken aback by how long a bag can take. And yes, it can take weeks to make a bag. But, you know, ultimately, they don't really care because when they do get the bag in hand, they realize that, oh my God, this is so worth it. This is way better than a bag that I could buy on Amazon for like a fraction of the price, right? So I've definitely noticed that customers have appreciated and understand slow fashion a little bit more. And I think to your point, Jameson, about like telling a story and creating a feeling, that has been so important to me. I mean, you know, I'm not just trying to make a company. I just want to share a part of who I am with everyone. And I think that's been possible because, I've just made it a real effort to try to tell my story in a very authentic way. And I think what you see is just a little bit of me. So everything from like the logo and to the pictures, I think folks are getting a feel of who I am. And I hope and I think that they're buying into who I am. You know, what you see is what you get. You know, this is me. This is Amy. And it just so happens that a part of me is translating into the brand Moticot or the bags that I offer with Moticot.
Are people surprised to hear that you're a one-woman business? I think it's very, like, it's really clear when you go to certain websites. Again, there's a lot of incredible gear companies out there, and I would never drop a name because they are all so special in many ways. But sometimes you enter a website and you're like, that's one dude in a garage for sure. Amazing packs, incredible stuff. That is a homemade site. But I don't have that feeling from you at all. I mean, from looking at your gear to like the incredible craftsmanship that it is, but also to on your website, on your Instagram, we know Avery and I know full well what it's like to try and run a marketing department, and there's at least two people here, and we get it wrong a lot of the times. How do you get it right so much?
Well, I don't know if I get it right so much, but thank you so much. That means a lot. And you're right; it really takes a village, right? And I think I try really hard to not say I, because I mean I am making the bags, I am sourcing the materials myself, but I think, you know, like Moticot is a result of, you know, people like my partner, Alex, who's helping me set up for this podcast, right? Like I cannot do it without people that have invested in me and are, you know, helping me in ways that, you know, probably aren't showing through the post. So, yeah, I'm making the bags myself for sure. Every single bag I make by myself. But there are other things that, you know, I really lean on my community for to help me get to where I am and get me to, you know, present these really awesome photos and this website. But yeah, I think that, you know, it's important for me to acknowledge like, yeah, I am the only person making them, but you know, it really does take a village to do everything else. Yeah.
One thing being a woman at Ripstop by the Roll, which I work with a lot of great people, but there aren't a lot of the ladies at the company. And so I really empathize with a lot of the women makers, and I have done a lot of like putting together a women's blog so we can see all the women's makers in one place. And I know, and I know Jameson also knows this, and you as well, Amy, but there's a slew of male makers, and there's nothing wrong against that at all. But why do you think there are so many more male MYOGers in general and also male-owned cottage companies as opposed to women-owned cottage companies or makers?
Yeah, I think that's something that I've been putting a lot of thought into as well, because when I started my journey in making my own gear, I didn't see a lot of faces that looked like me and, you know, not a lot of women. And I don't have an answer for that, really. All I know is that there really is a community out there. I think that just being able to highlight them, you know, we just haven't been able to highlight them. So Avery, thank you so much for putting that together, and Ripstop by the Roll for really putting that blog out there for everyone to see, because I think that's so important. There really are a lot of women makers. It's just a matter of finding them. And I've been so fortunate to be able to be part of this community, like Ripstop by the Roll, you guys, you know, tagging other companies. That's how I discover other women-owned companies too. So I think all I can say really is I'm not sure why that is, but I do know that they are out there, and that, you know, it's really our job to highlight them.
Yeah, I remember the first time I put it together, I came up with like a list of 20, and then we released it, and then more people kept adding and adding and adding to this list. And I was like, this is amazing. Like you said, they are out there. They might just be a little bit harder to find, or it's just always been such an interesting question for me, because I don't want to say grew up sewing, but I've been sewing for a while now and started in high school, and my mom knows what I do. She still can't stay Ripstop by the Roll right after 2.5 years, but she's still like, how are all these men sewing? I just don't understand. Like, that's something traditionally that like my grandmother would do, or my great grandmother would do, and make aprons. Yeah. So I think it's still so fascinating. I know there's, sorry to put you on the spot, because I know there's not an answer to the question. It's just interesting to ask another female maker, like, why do you think sewing being a traditionally female project or hobby, that it really is, it's become infiltrated with so many great male makers as well, because the MYOG community is so tight-knit, like seeing you guys support each other. And I know like you have a connection with Caitlin Arbrough, and she's done some
she is amazing
work for you, and like it's all the MYOG community like coming together. It's really beautiful for me to kind of like stand back and watch it all happen in a way.
I the community of women makers, we're out there, you know, and it whether it's sewing or photography or videography, you know, I think it's just a matter of finding each other. And yeah, Caitlin is an amazing woman. She's an amazing creative too. So I'm really glad that you saw that, Avery. Big shout out to you, Caitlin. And thank you for coming to visit me in San Francisco. But yeah, I mean, going back to what, you know, your mom said about like sewing, my mom, she worked in a factory. She sewed all her life, you know. She still sews a little bit here and there. But, you know, you oftentimes think about sewing and you relate that to a woman sewing, right? So I do think that it's great that we are highlighting men too in this area that we used to think was a predominantly women, you know, hobby or business or, you know, but yeah, I don't know. I think it's really awesome to see the shift in that. We're shifting and seeing a lot more women, coming forward with, you know, brands like Kel-Tec Gear. She's amazing, right? I love the work that she's putting out. And there's just so many others out there. So yeah, matter of just finding them. Yeah.
Leave it to guys to be like super specific about gender roles, and then also be super dominant about MYOG culture, right? like how can you be like, no, only my grandmother sews, and then be like, just kidding, I'm actually going to do all the sewing as well. I digress. But also I'm curious to see if more women in the future, because I think what I've noticed recently, and it's only come up since I started thinking about it in this conversation, but there's a lot of women makers and not a lot of makers turn to businesses, where I feel like a lot more guys start businesses sooner than women are maybe feeling confident starting business. Like there's all sorts of crazy studies about like entrepreneurship for men and women. It's not that a difference in skill. It's that like women are often a lot more put on the spot. They're like, well, I've only got 80% figured out. I don't want to go for it yet. Where guys are like, I've only got 50%. Mm-hmm. I'll go for it anyway. And I wonder if there's, I hope that gap is closing. I'd like to think it is. I don't have any proof to say that it is, but I'd love to think that more women are able to make companies. I mean, think of like Francesca, like she's an incredible maker. She doesn't have a business yet. She's a better maker than a lot of people that I know that do have businesses. It's not that I'm not making incredible gear, but she just makes her own clothes at home instead of sells them. It doesn't make her less of a maker if she doesn't have the brand yet.
Yeah. And it's so interesting, right? Not just in this MYOG community, we're seeing a lot more women in leadership roles, in all types of companies, tech and, I think that being around that energy when I was at Facebook and even before that, when I was working at a law firm, like I was around some badass women. And I think that it really gave me the confidence to, you know, I see a similarity there, right? Like I can really relate to this woman. And I've been definitely applying that. I would say that it has helped me in the confidence of starting my own company and going into, you know, entrepreneurship.
So all this talk about brand and helping companies grow and everything, what sort of advice, Amy? I mean, we do have some listeners that are, we have a lot of cottage companies that listen because they are makers at home, just making gear like a lot of us are. For those of us that are listening that are cottage companies, what advice would you give them to improve their brand or their or maybe just understanding why putting their story out there matters? That's really what you're talking a lot about. It's not like trying to create this image that's false or anything, what brand think of. It's putting your story or communicating your story in the most effective way possible, right? What would you suggest people try, or how do they learn to do that better?
Yeah, I am no expert in branding. I think that I've dabbled a lot with different things and just have tried to see what works. And I've tried to have a lot of fun with it. I think that's been the most important thing for me, is just making sure that, you know, by me starting this, that I'm staying true to myself and I'm not just doing it because I know that's going to create revenue or, you know, or followers. You know, it's not really about that, for me at least, you know. And I think one piece of advice is, you know, just keep in mind that your brand isn't just a logo and the colors that you pick. That's just a cosmetic aspect of a brand. But I think the most important thing, like you said, Jameson, is your story and the feeling that you give customers and how they relate to you. Because if someone cannot really relate to you, I don't think they're going to buy your bags, no matter how cool it is and how, you know, how many features it offers. If they can't relate to you as a person, I don't think that, you know, that's either one, just going to be a one-time purchase. But yeah, my piece of advice to other cottage companies is just to stay true to yourself, and just to check in with yourself constantly, to see whether or not what you're doing is what you should be doing. And it really makes marketing, storytelling, all of that good stuff just that much easier when it's just you, your authentic you, you know? So I think that would be like the one piece of advice, and probably consistency, because I think that, you know, when I'm in the thick of it, I don't want to record myself sewing, but I try to make it an effort, right? Because I want to share this experience with everyone. And it's not just like me doing it for other people, like it's for me too, so that, you know, I can feel a sense of community, right? So consistency is also really key, and just being able to articulate your story in a way that, you know, can resonate with others.
Speaking of just your brand and being recognizable in your gear and your content, and this is also off the record. It wasn't planned for me to say this, but I remember one of the first things that you tagged us in was like your organization, your drawer. And even now, just sitting behind you, like you have the same type of organization. Like I can see one of your pictures scrolling on the feed and know, like, okay, that's Modicott. Like I know what your pictures look like. And I think that just like rings true with who you are and how you carry your brand, that I'm sure not just myself can be scrolling through Instagram and immediately, without even seeing the username, recognize that it's your work, that it's your photo, you know? So I think it says a lot. Yeah, and it's really awesome to have that consistency and that brand recognability.
Thank you, Avery.
Yeah.
So I have maybe a really tough off the record question, but I would like to think that we are scissor aficionados here, but I've seen scissors on your wall that I've never seen in our shop. So what, like, enlighten us. I feel like we might need to convince Carter to buy more of these.
So let me show you these really quickly. These are hands down my favorite.
Those are good. So those are very good.
Oh my gosh. So you
we
know
have
these.
Those. Yeah, those are the ones that we do have.
Okay. Yeah. So these are the Kai 7205s. These are like a high carbon stainless steel shears. And I probably should actually get a longer one, but these are my absolute favorite. And so I would say for anyone, especially like women out there who are sewing or anyone with smaller hands and that work with really heavy duty material, this is the one for you. And then the other ones that I have, I mean, I just use Fiskars shears as well. They never dull on me, even when I'm like cutting, you know, Vizlon zippers and all of that. So that's another go-to for me. And then I don't know how to say these shears. They're Ginghar?
Sounds good.
But I have pinking shears. Okay. I actually use pinking shears too. And I remember when I bought them, people were like, why? What is that? You know, that's like old lady stuff. But no, they really help. So I primarily use my Kais, an old pair of shears that my mom actually used back in the day. I don't have it with me, but they're really, really long. And I use these Ginghar.
I'm butchering it.
Ginghar. Yeah. Yeah. Those are really awesome too. Yeah.
Okay, so I promised that we'd get to design. So let's start to talk about your products and design style around there. So in the words that I could conjure while scrolling through your website and Instagram, I would say that your design style is pristine, active inspired, almost like Scandinavian in its simplicity, but still like very fashion centric. And the word that you used earlier, which I'm glad because I didn't want to put you in this category entirely, was like EDC.
Yes.
For those of you that are trying to picture this in your head now, Amy's gear is beautiful through simplicity, but also has no lack of functionality whatsoever. Hearing me use those adjectives to describe your gear, what does that make you feel? And what did I miss?
I mean, that makes me feel really good. I think it's really hard for me to like talk about my actual like product sometimes because I don't know, I'm just kind of making bags because it just feels like me. And hearing you say like pristine and clean and like kind of like Scandinavian-ish, like that rings a little true because I think that I try to aim for like a and I really don't really like this word either, but minimalistic, like, you know, kind of feel without compromising on like form or function, right? So I want to make sure that it's a high functioning bag. And, you know, I'm in San Francisco, so we have a lot of microclimates. So it's really important to be able to adapt. So the adaptability of my bags is also a really critical piece for me as well. And then I can show you, Jameson, like how that all plays out with the two bags that you have. But yeah, I try not to compromise on function whatsoever. So you can trust that I've done a lot of testing on every single one of my bags, sometimes to a fault where I don't even release something for like a year. But yeah, I would say that that's pretty accurate, and it does make me feel good to see and hear that that's kind of resonating with others. So thank you, Jameson.
Yeah, for sure.
With all of those descriptors that Jameson gave, pristine, Scandinavian, to get down to the bottom of it, where does your design style come from?
I think my design style comes from, well, one, just at the core of just who I am, but also, you know, my environment. I think that I draw a lot of design inspiration from just where I live. I mean, San Francisco is such a dope city and just made of tons and tons of different artists and creatives in all different kinds of mediums. And so I think that my design style kind of is pulled from my community. And at the core of it really is just who I am, right? So like if you're looking at a bag of mine, it's oftentimes like a solid color. Most of the time it's black because I just love black. But I like to add a little pop of color because I think that I don't want to blend in fully. But I'm not really like a loud person, like visually, you know? And so having a little hint of color is kind of like my, you know, where the right medium for me. So yeah, I would say that my design style comes from like my environment. Yeah. And just who I am.
I love hearing people talk about like simplicity and like really like simple tones, because it's like a big thing, which is awesome, by the way, in the MYOG community, to make like the wildest piece of gear you can find. And I love that there's a space for that. And I love that people can do that and feel really stoked with that. But I get so much bleep word every time I make something, just out of like, hey, I'm going to use like X-Pack RX36. And Carter's like, bro, he's like, for the love of God, would you make something with color? I'm like, but I don't want to. I like it this way. But look, the inside is turquoise blue. He's like, it's black. It's just a black bag.
The way I think about it is like, you know, I'm rocking my bag out in the city. I don't want to be noticed. But when I open the bag, I want to feel
happy or something. Yeah.
A moment of joy, yes. You know? And I think that's kind of how I go about my bags.
Yeah, I love that. So as a small company, it's really important to figure out how to innovate and find new developments. How do you... like, where's your next bag coming from? How do you find the inspiration to continue the evolution of Motocot?
I think that my lineup of bags that I have in mind, like, there's tons. But I think it really – priority takes I think that need actually takes priority. So when I'm going about my day and I'm seeing, you know, oh, my God, I think I should make a – tote on steroids probably, because I am carrying all this crap with me from my house to the studio. I need something that will hold everything. So I think that is really priority for me most of the time. Just how do I make my own life easier? When I hear customers reach out and, you know, if there is more than one instance, I know that that's a cue for me to start thinking about something, because I am a very solution oriented person. And so when someone's coming to me with an issue with, you know, a gap that they see or feel in the bags that they own, I want to solve that problem. And I think that's kind of where my list comes from. So my next one coming up is this backpack that's behind me. When I talked about, you know, me sitting on a prototype for so long, I've been testing this bag for so long. It's a roll top backpack. So I think that this is probably the one that's going to come up next. And then some... then probably a tote after that, because I need a tote myself. Yeah.
One thing that we've learned talking to a lot of different creatives is that they don't typically just have one hobby. Obviously, sewing is a hobby and typically whatever they're sewing for, whatever their outdoor activity is. But what other creative outlets do you have that you engage in?
Maybe it's obvious, but maybe not. But I love photography. And I think primarily analog photography. I think that's something that I've always been excited about. And I was, you know, really in the thick of it for a while before I started Motocot. But things got really expensive, so I had to, you know, pull the brakes on that. But yeah, analog photography is my number one, I would say. It allows me to really tap into a creative world that I think no other medium really allows me to. And it's kind of like storytelling, right? And so street photography is a big thing for me. My partner and I, my partner, Alex, he's actually a DP and a producer by trade. So photography is just right up our alley, right? And yeah, I think photography is my other creative outlet, I would say. And I probably should pick that up a little bit more. But analog photography, and then now I've been dabbling a little bit with digital. And digital actually really overwhelmed me for a long time, because there's all these buttons and there's settings that I don't know. In analog, you just don't have to deal with that. But yeah, I think I'm doing a okay job. A lot of the photos that you see on the website, those are done by me too. So
what do you shoot with film wise?
My good old Minolta. So my Minolta camera is my number one, and it's just a very good entry-level camera and just has never failed on me. And then my other camera that's my favorite is a medium format. It's the Mamiya RB67. Creates just amazing photos.
I'm just
there's nothing else like
geeking
it.
Geeking out over here with you, because I – was trained in film photography, and it's something I picked back up recently at the end of this year. And wow. I also have a Minolta, and I love her. She's great. So I'm also the kind of person that will like take a roll of film and then I let it sit for like 2 years. So it's a real surprise when you like send your film in 3 years later yes. and you're like, oh my God, this is, it's like so rewarding after the fact, other than like we're living in this digital moment where like you take the 30 pictures of the one that you want to post and then you like never think about it again. But it's like the gift that keeps on giving when you use film yes. photography, because it's gratifying then, but then you get it developed and you're like, depending on if you're like me or not, and you wait X amount of years, then it is truly, it's just like constantly rewarding in that sense. So we'll have to geek out more about that later, but
we'll have to take that offline. But I don't know about you, but I have a fridge full of film that I have to develop. So I think I'm right there with you. Probably like a few years old. But, you know, it's interesting to think about analog photography and how it kind of has a lot of similarities to sewing and the slow fashion that I was talking about earlier. You know, the delayed gratification. I think we just as people are just not used to waiting. And I think that... yeah, maybe that's why I gravitate towards the two.
It's such a good conversation. And I mean, I probably could talk about this all day, but with the fast fashion and the photography and just how on demand life went during COVID. And you're one of the makers that said during COVID, you were like, you know, you could have kept getting things on demand, your groceries on demand, your toilet paper on demand, but taking a step back really and saying, okay, well, I'm going to like, really go old school. We're going to go back 60 years and we're going to yes. start making our own stuff, which that's how a lot of the world went with making bread, making whatever they were making, their victory gardens, all these things. So it's really interesting yes. that there's so many similar hobbies between a lot of the NYOGers. I know that Jameson, we've talked before about Lego Kids, has come up a lot of just like having that instilled nature of wanting to build something and be gratified by something that you physically made and you can see the results of. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We don't use our hands as much as we used to. And I think that people are starting to tap back into that, and it's so fun to see.
Absolutely. So going forward with that, a huge part of your brand story is sustainability and an ethic of non-waste. This all going back to the name of your company, Modicot. So how do you practice sustainability within your business?
I think whenever possible, I try to reuse any of the scraps that I have. And yeah, I mean, at the core of just who I am, I don't want to waste anything. I'm always reluctant to let things go. So you can trust that, you know, some of the part of the bag is probably reused from something. Whenever I can, I try to reuse household items. I don't really put this on my social media very much, but like, I've been collecting rice bags for over a year now, and I am so excited to make like a run of bags made out of rice bags. I mean, that stuff is super durable. You can use that camping, you know? And yeah, I think just, I try to save what I can and try to keep things out of landfill, because if I'm able to repurpose something for like one more year, that means that's one more year that material is not in landfill. So yeah, I try to do that. And that was actually how my Slim Wallet was born. I was in the middle of making, I think, a breakaway bag, and I wanted a quick little creative break, and I pulled some of the scraps that I had, and I made a Slim Wallet out of it. So yeah.
That's such a good way to use the scraps, because I like it's something I think about a lot. I've been making like these little ZPPs for the Mountains of Sea Trail. We've been like, we give nice. Them away, and like, you know, you box a corner and there's like a little bit of a thing I have to chop off. So I don't know, made like 12 of those, and there's four corners. You do the math. There's a lot of corners that are just floating out there, and I never know exactly. like what to do with those little pieces. Now that's maybe a bad example, because I don't know what you would do like with the already somewhat like bind bound corner of something, but like those little bits, there probably are little projects. And I love like the wallet. It's a great example of like, there are probably these little, like really small projects that can be made with those little scraps. Cause I totally agree. It's annoying to like see something. I do it. You become a little bit jaded isn't the right word. You become a little bit desensitized to fabric working here at Ripstop because it's like literally all around us all the time. So you like, you walk by like a roll of X-Pack or like DCF, like it doesn't like, it's not the same effect as you, I first had when you walk and you're like, oh my God, it's like $10,000 of DCF. Like eventually you're like, yeah, it's DCF, it's on the floor, whatever. You become a little bit desensitized, but like, I still feel bad. Like when I cut it off and then throw it away, like if I see it in the office, it's one thing, but like when I like, you know, make the final cut and just like slowly and sadly drop it into the trash can, it's like, but that's a good idea. Like I like that idea of like thinking of really small projects to use those scraps for. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. And keeping a scrap bin, I think that's been my saving grace, because it's so easy to just toss things in the trash, right? Or the recycling, but having a scrap bin, you can just rummage through that. Oh, I need, you know, 2 inches of this 1 inch webbing. Like I would rather pull that from my scrap bin so that I can make a little pull for my bag than to use it from the new roll that I have. So yeah, you just never know. And that could be good and bad, I guess. Because the scrap bin could be really...
Yeah, that's so true. That's a good idea, though, because I was going to ask, like, you know, what's a tangible way that makers at home can think about using those scraps and whatnot? But I hadn't thought about, I mean, to also a point you made earlier, organized scrap bins is probably a great idea. Like you are you are perfectly epitomizing organization, at least behind you for everybody here. That's such a good idea to like think about. Like, I don't know, we could make bins like things that are smaller than 6 inches, things that are longer than 12 inches. And like even a small bit of organization with scraps could go a long way. I mean, especially if you're like me and use the same 5 fabrics all the time, it'll probably end up being the same one you're using anyway.
Yeah. You just never know.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's easier once things are organized. It just makes it less daunting to have to like rummage through everything. So that's a really good idea.
So what is your organization process for your scraps? I'm curious to know, because like Jameson said, and anyone watching knows that like everything looks labeled, it's got its place. So, I mean, some people with scraps, especially myself, I just have like one big organized bin, but how do you break it down for us?
So I break it down depending on the size actually too. So anything that's smaller than like thread or anything, I can't reuse that. So I just automatically toss that into the trash bin. But anything that's bigger than maybe, I don't know, 3 by 3 or something, I would definitely save. And I certainly do find use for those little pieces. And then larger pieces, I have a larger like scrap bin for fabrics that I could probably sew together and do some patchworking with. And then hardware, that's another thing. I geek out on hardware. And so I cannot throw away a buckle. Like, trust me, I cannot do that. And so I have in my organized bin or drawer that I have on IG, there is a like scrap section where there is like one-off buckles that I probably can't do like a run of bags, but I can make one of one bags with them. So that's how I try to organize it on my end. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing. I know every time you post one of your pictures or videos, people just like geek out. It is like, I don't want to say a naughty word, but it's like sewing porn.
You know, that's actually how Caitlin found me.
Oh, wow.
Caitlin found me through that video. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah. So there's been an ongoing debate on whether or not MYOG is more or less sustainable than buying gear. Mm. Let's hear what you think about that.
I mean, I guess it depends on how you look at it. It's definitely better for the environment. I know that from my perspective, at least, and how I'm, you know, reusing materials. But I mean, if you're thinking about it in terms of, you know, I mean, in terms of like how long something will take, like you probably will spend like $90 on materials that you're probably going to make like one sweater out of or something, you know, like that's really real. And I want to acknowledge that. Right. But I think that if you are, you know, trying to leverage things around the house, that kind of MYOG work is most definitely environmentally friendly. So I would say that I stand on the side where, you know, yes, it is more environmentally friendly. debate me.
Slide in Amy's DMs with your thoughts.
Sustainability is another one of those words that I don't want to say it's taboo, but like every big company has like a sustainability mission and like there's a webpage on it and they have like a chief sustainability officer and like all those things. And I want to make sure we give you enough credit. It's probably not entirely fair to say that you champion sustainability. You certainly do, but it's like, now that we've learned more about Modocot, it's not really just like a practice that you do, but it's like very intrinsic to who you are and like kind of the, it's a lot more part of like the ethos of your company than it is like something you slapped on the band-aid of like, oh, we should be sustainable. We'll try it out now. how do you suggest that people take on the mindset and kind of the like a more effortless sense of sustainability or of Modocot than just having it be like, oh, I do this because it's a hot topic now?
You know, I would challenge people to really think about the things that they're putting in the trash, really. You know, maybe asking yourself, you know, is there a way to repurpose or upcycle this shirt or whatever it is that I'm about to toss? You know, and just kind of taking that one step can go a long way. And I try to do that myself, right, with everything. So, you know, I'm going to donate this, but like, can I actually repurpose this in a way to fit a need that I have already versus me having to go buy something to create a solution for an issue, right? So I would challenge people just to ask that one additional question before you toss something. And I mean, that's for material goods, but you know, the nothing goes to waste mindset, I think, can and I think certainly should be applied to just a mindset, right? You know, thinking about how you're spending your time and your energy has been really important for me as a person and just making this transition from like a tech job to like owning Modocot. I think that is a way for folks to kind of take on this nothing goes to waste mindset. It could look physical and it could also look very mental, right? I would say that.
So I'm not the only person that like saves the foam inserts from a bag and be like, oh, I can totally make that into like a support thing for the next bar bag I'm making.
Oh, you totally can.
I totally do. I've done it so much now to the point where like my wife opened up, like we were giving each other presents like every day this week as we lead up to Christmas. And she like pulled out like this foam insert. She's like, hey, do you want this? So, like you can sew with it for something. And I was like, I've trained you so well. You already know.
Yes. I love that. See, you're totally taking on the nothing goes to waste mindset, and your wife too. And it's so cool to see like my family, like they really help with the company, right? In terms of, you know, the bubble things that you use for shipping, you know, all of that is from other shipments, right? So I'm repurposing that as well because I'm not going to buy these air puffs, you know, but I do need them, right? To make sure the bags arrive good for my customers. So, you know, thinking about it in that way too, and leveraging your family and the people around you, like sharing that same kind of mindset, it just makes it, it's addicting to think, you know, about and work in that way because, you know, it's like a cool exchange. Like I save certain things for, you know, a friend and that friend will save these bubble wraps for me or, you know, vice versa. So, leveraging the people around you too, that's a good way to really implement that mindset.
I was going to say, I feel like we have a new competition coming up for next year. We're going to do the maker challenge again, but make it scraps only. Strange items, or we got to find a better word for that. But unconventional material maker challenge and have people see your rice bags turn into awesome breakaway bags or fanny packs. Yeah. So that's really inspiring. And then also just makes me think of like, you look like the most organized hoarder I've ever seen. Like Marie Kondo and hoarders from TLC came together and like.
Is it hoarding? Is it hoarding if it's organized?
Great question. Dr. Phil, we'll have to ring him for that one.
I don't want to end the conversation, but we have officially run out of the official questions on the outline and used our time fully. Amy, you are a beautiful human being. We're so glad we were able to share some time with you. Thank you for sharing your story about Motocot, your background, and how we can use little fabric scraps a little bit more wisely.
Thank you so, so much for having me.
Where can people find you? We'll put all the links in the description and you can check them out online. But for anyone listening and you know that they can't go click on that link, they got to go to your website right now. Where do they find you?
DM me. I am very active on Instagram to a fault. But there's a real human being behind that handle and it's me answering your questions. So if you have any questions about material, you know, just, you know, other ways that we are repurposing materials in the house, et cetera, I am more than happy to engage in conversation. Do not hesitate. I don't bite. So IG me. I guess it's not really IG. It's DM me or email me, whatever it is. Just I will respond.
And that's at Motocot?
Yeah, at Motocot. Yep.
Cool.
On Instagram. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, Avery and I have, if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, then we have this thing that we jokingly call like the Rip Stop by the Roll road trip. And it's like all these people were like, man, they're so rad. We got to go hang out with them. So when Avery and I talk next, which is going to be in like probably 10 minutes or something, we're going to be like, man, we got to go to San Francisco now. Like Amy's on the road trip.
I have to give you guys a studio tour.
I know. And also congratulations on your new studio. I hope that people who are listening probably have a lot of great takeaways from different things that you've said throughout the past hour. But I also hope to the makers who are out there just sewing their first wallet or ZPP kit that they kind of see your story and realize that they too could in 2 years with some hard work and dedication and just like belief in yourself have your own studio from your kitchen table to your own space. So that's one thing that's been really inspiring for me to see and to watch you grow. And we're just huge fans of you here at Ripstop. There's like 10 people's names that will just like constantly spitball and come up and yours is definitely one of them. So it's been great to chat with you today and to learn more about you. And thank you for sharing all of your knowledge with us.
Thank you to Avery and Jameson for like really providing the space for makers like me, right? I don't know any other company that does this. So the work that you two do and everyone else at Ripstop by the Roll, Lance, right? You guys make it possible for makers and business owners like me. And I have to say too, I didn't mention this earlier and I probably should have, but I made my first few batch of bags that I sold out of materials from Ripstop by the Roll. And I still use your materials. Like those two bags that you have in your hand, a lot of that material is from you guys. So thank you very, very much for making it possible for me.
All right. Well, until next time, Amy, we're rooting for you. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, y'all.